You're listening to QSO. It's all about ham radio. Our guest this week is Ronnie Millsap, and you're listening to QSO on WBCQ, 7415 kilohertz. Heard Sundays, 3 p.m. Eastern and 11 p.m. Eastern. Be sure and check out the website, www.tedrandall.com. That's www.tedrandall.com, spelled T-E-D-R-A-N-D-A-L-L. Well, we're with Ronnie Millsap.
Hey, Mr. Ted Randall, how you doing, man?
It's great to be with you.
It's great to be with you, Ronnie. Here is a star ham radio operator, and I don't mean it from the entertainment industry. I mean it from a fellow that started getting interested in ham radio.
Very early.
At an early age.
Yeah.
And worked. He's told me some stories, and I want you to share with me, if you would.
Sure.
First, give everybody your call sign here so everybody
knows. My call letters are WB4KCG, WB4 Kind Country Gentleman in Nashville, Tennessee.
And he is a kind country gentleman indeed, even... I will have to say that from...
I just happened to wind up with those call letters. It was totally at random. That call issued in 1968, and I was so glad that I passed my general. I passed it in Atlanta, and I had this job at the Playboy Club in Atlanta in 1967. Through a portion of 1968, I was studying for the general test, and I thought I could pass the code with no sweat, but I knew I could not pass the theory unless I studied for it. So I'm playing six sets a night at the Playboy Club, and I have all my Braille notes and everything I can find that has been given to me to study the theory to pass the general test. So I would play 45 minutes, and I was off 15 minutes. So I would usually get my Braille stuff. As soon as I'd play my 45 minutes, I'd get my Braille stuff and go to the bar, get my scotch and soda, light a cigarette, and start studying my notes and start studying. And that's, you know, after like 4 or 5 months, I thought I was ready to go take the general. So my wife took me over there to the examiner for the FCC in Atlanta, and I did the test. He said, "You passed the code, no problem. Let's find out about the theory." And so that's, thank goodness it was multiple choice, but I passed that. And he said, you're gonna get your call sign in the mail. Well, I happened to be in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, at the opening of a brand new Playboy Club up there, when somebody called and said, "Your call letters have been assigned to you, and you've got your ham license, your general license." I said, "Well, what are my call letters?" And they said, "WB4KCG." I said, "Wow, that is really cool, man." So we came and got back to Atlanta. I started getting on the radio. Let's see, what did I have to begin with? I think I had a TR3 or something like that. I had Drake. I was really into that those things. And then I got the Drake Twins, the B series, the R4B and the TX4B, and so I was running those and actually got on the radio and started, and eventually moved to Memphis and passed my advanced class. And that's as far as I've gone. But I love ham radio, and I love being on the low bands. I love being on HF, and I love being on VHF, too. Just comes from that love, I think, radio has been so important in my life as long as I can remember. And it's by the time I was 8 or 9 years old, when I was at the State School for the Blind in Raleigh, North Carolina, there were kids older than I, and they had their ham license. And we had this shack set up down in the basement of one of the dormitories. And I got to go over there and watch them. And I said, man, I want to get my ham license. So I think I was probably, it took me a while. I was about 15, 16 in that area before I ever decided I wanted to take my novice test. So I took my novice test and I got that. Then I started getting on down there in this cool ham shack in the basement of one of the dormitories on campus. And I started making those CW contacts, and, man, it was just so cool. And I remember I eventually moved that stuff up into my room, my dormitory room, and I was running... I had a receiver, a Helicrafters S-40B, and I had this this transmitter that was a Globe Chief. I'm trying to remember, Ted, it seems like it would put out like 90 watts, I think, key down, 90 watts. And so, man, I would work folks in Canada and folks all over the United States, and they'd send me QSL cards, and I'd send them back QSL cards. And so I've been loving ham radio all my life.
When you were really young, and I don't want to get into anything too personal, but tell us a little bit about your life story, and that is from the time you were a child, early years, you know, from birth, mom and dad, to the school of the blind. How did you go from there, your early beginnings?
My early beginnings were extreme poverty. I'm from Meadow Branch, a community in Graham County, North Carolina, which is adjacent to East Tennessee. So I'm in Appalachia. I'm in the Smoky Mountains. And that's where I was born, in Robbinsville, North Carolina, the county seat of Graham County. And I grew up with my grandparents because my mother did not want to deal with a blind child. She did not want a blind child. So my daddy took me over to his mother's house, which had been my grandmother, and they got me when I was a year and a day old. So it would have been on January the 17th, 1944, that they got me, and they raised me. So my mother didn't want me, and I don't feel bad about that today. Of course, I've learned that, how to deal with that, years ago. And the thing I discovered, I was a little bit late to come along, maybe late walking, but it's really weird. People say that you cannot remember this, but I actually do. I remember the environment of the house. I remember it was so good because we had love there. I even remember crawling. So crawling happened after I'd turned 1 year old. I turned just 1 year old, and I remember crawling around in the house. And I remember how I learned to walk, and I remember I was using the bedposts and the bed rail of my grandmother's bed. And I'd use that as a guide. And I had a little bit of vision at the time in my left eye, a little bit of vision. But it was amazing once they always had the radio going early in the morning, because we lived over in, you know, in this area, and it was very poor. No plumbing, no water, no electricity, outhouse. And, boy, that's cold at 3 o'clock in the morning. I mean, wind blowing and all that's some cold stuff. And I think when they had the radio on early in the morning, I was attracted to that. And I'd hear an old Philco radio that they had that ran on a huge 90-volt battery that sat right under the radio on a shelf. The radio sat up on the top shelf, and the battery sat on the shelf under it. And we had a long antenna on there, or as they called it back in those days, a radio aerial. It was a long wire, and that's all it was. But I got attracted to hearing this radio early in the morning from WNOX over in Knoxville and WSM in Nashville and all kinds of stations around where we were, WWNC in Asheville, North Carolina. And I just absolutely was so attracted to the radio. It made this sound, and I heard music. And I found out pretty quickly by the time I was, say, 3 years old, that I could memorize melodies and lyrics to a song. If I heard it a couple of times, I had it down. So I had almost a photographic memory for, you know, somebody saying the great speckled bird. I could sing it in a couple of days. Somebody sang any songs that, and that was all in that part of the country, all country music. Bluegrass was extremely influential in my early life. We heard that a lot. I loved Flat and Scruggs back in those days. I loved bluegrass, and of course, a whole lot of gospel music. And so I love this Philco radio. It was my window to the world, and I absolutely loved it. So I wanted to know what's going on with this radio, and I'm 3 years old, and I want to. While everybody's gone to work, and my grandfather gone to work, my grandmother was doing other things around the house, and you know, on the washboard or outside, and you know, we had carry water in from a spring and all that, so I wanted to find out what's in the back of this radio. So I pulled it out from the wall and started looking back there, and there was all those tubes in there. And I said, yeah, I wonder what that is. So I started disassembling our only entertainment center that we had, which was our Philco radio, and taking it apart and looking at it, and the dials and the tubes and anything else I could pull out. And so when Homer Frisbee, my grandfather, got home, he was really upset. And he never spanked me. He never did. My grandmother usually would put a switch to me. She'd go out and cut a hickory switch and hit me with that, you know. And a lot of times, you know, I'd be running around in shorts or something, or running around. I'll tell the truth, actually. So in summertime, when it was warm, I'd just be running around in my underwear. You know, up there was nobody there. We were a long way from anybody. So we're up there in a remote location, and I love this radio. And so Homer Frisbee and my uncle, who was also living in the house, their son, J.C. Frisbee, my daddy was there, James Millsap. And Millsaps, that's the actual family name. But they wound up figuring a way to reassemble the radio. And so now we got our Philco radio back. And I decided I'm not going to do that again. I'm not going to take it apart again. So I was four. And by the time I was four, I remember being taken to a couple of doctors in Asheville to determine exactly what the extent of my blindness was going to be. And it's amazing. I remember even the doctor I went to see in Asheville, Dr. Weisenblock, a lady who made the determination that I was going to have no vision in my right eye, and whatever vision I had in my left eye would probably be constant and would be all I'd ever have. There was no way to improve that vision. And then by the time I was five, I really actually remember sitting on the floor in the kitchen on my birthday, on my fifth birthday, and I'm saying to myself, now you're 5 years old. You don't know where this life journey is going to take us. Just remember this moment in time, sitting in the kitchen here, and you're 5 years old, January the 16th, 1948. Remember that you're sitting in the kitchen here and hold on to this memory all the time, every time you want to come back to it while you're on the earth. And I do remember that. And, of course, singing publicly was something I was not afraid to do. And the only place I could do that was at the church, Meadow Branch Baptist Church. So I would sing publicly down there when I was five. And I had no musical training, of course, so I would just sing. I'd stand up in the aisle, or I'd ease up. I could see to go up to the pulpit. I'd get up there close to the pulpit, and I would just sing. And by the time I became, the time I turned six, they decided that the welfare is always involved in these situations because, you know, we're poor people. We're a poor family. We have no car. We have nothing. We're able to get something to eat. My grandmother was a wonderful cook. I mean, she cooked all those high cholesterol meals, and goodness, I still think of those breakfasts, you know, with the fried apples and all that. And I guess I don't mean to plug anybody, but the thing that comes the closest to that is Cracker Barrel, old country store. Because at least when you eat breakfast there, it's just like it was at my grandmother's house. And I absolutely love that. But the welfare department in Graham County, North Carolina, decided that they need to find some way to get me to school. There's a school in Raleigh, which at that time was called the State School for the Blind. And they decided that I needed to go there, and it was the only way that I would ever have a chance to have a decent life. And my Uncle J.C. Frisbee, and I remember the gentleman from the welfare department in Graham County at that time was named Arnold Hyde. And by then, J.C., my uncle, had married. They married March the 18th, 1949. And so I was going to be sent to school in Raleigh. And I was going to be taken away from my grandparents, 400 miles away to this special school in Raleigh. And I remember we stopped the first night in Asheville on our trip to Raleigh. And that was the first time I'd ever been to a hotel room that had running water. I didn't know what running water was. So they got a sink in there, and they got this device over here that you push this handle, and it flushes and goes whoosh. I'd never heard that. I didn't know anything about that because, you know, I was out. I was in the outhouse with the Sears catalog. So we went on to Raleigh, and we checked in at the Sir Walter Raleigh Hotel. So we were there to spend the night, and then next day we were going to. It must have been Labor Day. If I had my virtual calendar here, I could figure out what that day was. But so we were, We went over to see the school the next day and walk around, and then we would go back to the hotel. And actually, then they took me on Tuesday, the next day, back over to the school in Raleigh. And they tried to explain to me that they were gonna have to go back to Graham County, 400 miles away, and they were gonna have to leave me at this school in Raleigh. And this it's a 90-acre campus, but it was I was in a dormitory, and the first dormitory where the 6-year-olds were, and they said they were gonna have to leave me there. That they would take care of me, and there was a house mother, and they would take care of me. And so my uncle and aunt and Mr. Hyde, they left on their way back to Western North Carolina. And I'm there by myself at the school in Raleigh. I remember lying on the rug downstairs and crying my heart out. I absolutely thought I'd been totally abandoned. I remembered the Bible story about Joseph when he was sold into slavery down in Egypt from the Bible and from going to church. And I thought, this is exactly what has happened to me. I've been sold into slavery, into some strange place. And 6 years old, I could not deal with it. I was just crying so hard, and the house mother came and picked me up and took me out front and set me on the porch steps out front. Some, seemed like there were 4 or 5 steps, concrete steps. So I sat there crying on the steps out front of the dormitory. And all of a sudden I started hearing somebody else crying. And I eased my way over to this other person, and he said, "Who are you?" And I said, "I'm Ronald Millsaps." And he said, "Well, I'm Larry Atwell." And I said, "Larry, where are you from?" He said, "I'm from Monroe, North Carolina." "Where are you from?" I said, "Meadow Branch, North Carolina." And he said, "Well, where is that?" And I said, "That's a long way off. It's way over there close to Knoxville, Tennessee." So all of a sudden we became, in the matter of a few minutes, the closest of friends. So that's how I met my first friend. And once you make one friend, we didn't cry anymore. And so we started hearing all of these other children crying around. So we started trying to find out who they were. And then kids who were in the first grade and the second grade were also in this dormitory. So they're the older kids. And so I started getting the chance to meet them. And they enroll us in kindergarten. And they start teaching us. Braille was the first thing they started to teach us. You're blind. You're going to have to learn Braille. You need to learn how to spell your name. "Ronald, do you know how to spell your name?" I said, "Yes, ma'am, R-O-N-A-L-D. "Do you know how to spell your last name?" "Yes, ma'am, I do." Can you count to 100? I said, "Yes, ma'am, I can." "Can you count to 100 by fives, by tens?" I said, "Yes, ma'am." "Well, do it for me. 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 30. "Okay, you know how to do that." And so they started us in Braille immediately with a slate and a stylus and paper. And so I remember one thing that was kind of interesting, I do remember. So we had two homeroom teachers in kindergarten. One was Mrs. Benton, who was my teacher, and the other was Mrs. Lewis. So there was such a big class in kindergarten, it took two teachers to handle it. But Mrs. Lewis had a set of scales over there. So I remember going over there, and she recorded our weight. And I remember what I weighed at 6 years old. So I was probably pretty, I must have been eating pretty well because I remember I was 63 pounds at six, and I think that's pretty heavy. So all of a sudden it's Christmas, Ted, and I have to go back for 10 days to Graham County. And my grandfather, Homer Frisbee, rode the bus, Carolina Trailways, to Raleigh, and rode with me back to all the way back to Topton, North Carolina, where we got off the bus. We went Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill, Burlington, Greensboro, High Point, Thomasville, Lexington, Salisbury, Statesville, Hickory, Morganton, Marion, Old Fort, Black Mountain, and Asheville. Then we had to change buses, and we went Canton, Waynesville, Silva, Bryson City, Cherokee, and Topton. And somebody was waiting at the bus stop in Topton with a car and drove us over through Robbinsville and over to Meadow Branch. And then Homer and I, my grandfather, Homer and I, walked up the hill for about a half a mile. And I was back at the home with my grandparents where I'd learned how to crawl, learned how to walk, learned how to listen to the radio, learned how to take it apart, and also learned how to put it back together. So I was home for my first Christmas for 10 days, and all of a sudden I got to go back to Raleigh. And Homer, my grandfather, went back with me to Raleigh. And I had to go through all that heartbreak all over again by getting back after Christmas. So it's January the 2nd or 3rd, I think, January 1950 by then, and I'm back in school. And I didn't get out of school until like June the 9th of 1950, out for the summer, for my first summer. So I was in school 9 months, or a little over 9 months a year, and then I went back home to the land of poverty. At the school for the blind, they had everything. They had books, they had running water, they had a bed to sleep in. It was very comfortable. They had plenty of food. They had great food. They had cooks, and we had house parents who my first house parent, the house mother, was very unforgiving and very mean to a lot of the kids because I came out of nowhere. I didn't know how to hold a fork. I didn't know how to do anything much. And she'd say, "Do you understand me, Ronald Lee? Ronald Lee, come here to me." And I knew when she said, "Ronald Lee, come here to me," I knew I was in a whole lot of trouble. So, you know, she physically back in those days, Ted, for some reason, they allowed the house parents to just beat up on the kids. That wouldn't be happening today, but, you know, they'd slap you in the face if you said something wrong, slap you right in the face, and if you hit you on the side that I couldn't see you on, I didn't even know it was coming. She'd say something to me, and I'd say, "Huh?" And she said, pow, she'd hit me in the face as hard as she could. She said, "Don't you say huh to me, you say ma'am." I said, "Yes, ma'am, yes, ma'am." And so she called me out of kindergarten one day, and she said, "Ronald Lee, come here to me." And I thought, "Oh, Lord, what have I done now?" And she said, "Come upstairs to your room." This was after lunch we had. And she said, "What is this on the wall?" I said, "That's my chewing gum." "Your chewing gum? What is it doing on the wall?" I said, "I was chewing it last night. I wanted to chew it. I wanted to keep chewing it." "Don't you know you don't put chewing gum on the wall?" But I had done that back at home at Meadow Branch with my grandparents. And she said, "Well, you don't do it here." I said, "You're going to whip me, aren't you?" And she said, "Yes, I am. I am going to whip you. So bend over." So she gave me about, I don't know, 10 licks, you know, with the paddle. And so I didn't put my chewing gum on the wall anymore. But I must say, Ted, going to the School for the Blind in Raleigh, North Carolina, which now is called the Governor Moorhead School for the Blind in Raleigh, was the best thing that could ever happen to me. I remember every single teacher, every person I came in contact with over there, and academic.
You're listening to QSO. It's all about ham radio. Our guest this week is Ronnie Millsap, and you're listening to QSO on WBCQ, 7415 kilohertz. Heard Sundays, 3 p.m. Eastern and 11 p.m. Eastern. Be sure and check out the website, www.tedrandall.com. That's www.tedrandall.com, spelled T-E-D-R-A-N-D-A-L-L.
At that time, you could really honestly get a real first-rate education. You can't get a good education anywhere anymore, certainly not in the public schools. The public school system is broken in America now. But I came through in the 50s. And it was segregated, I'm sorry to say. I didn't want it that way, but I didn't know anything about it. There was a school for the blind for all the white students in Raleigh. And another city that was close to Raleigh named Garner, there was a school for the blind for all the black students. And one of the happiest moments of my life was when I was about 10, I think, in an assembly program. They brought the black students over to play for us in assembly. And this group was called the Rhythm Kids. And, man, they were playing the Why Do Fools Fall in Love. They were playing songs that I'd heard on the radio, and I was so excited about that. And I was discovered, I guess, the aptitude tests that they did, that I had an attraction to music. So when I was 7 years old, I went and was selected to study violin. And then I was selected to start studying piano when I was 8. My violin teachers were named Mr. Wallace Greaves, and quite a teacher. Instill discipline, learn to play the violin. I didn't know what a violin was. I'd heard of a fiddle before. And then I discovered, hey, that's the same thing. It's the same instrument. And then my first piano teacher, I remember going in, I guess, when I was 9, because this was out in 1952, and playing Down Yonder on the piano for her. Del Wood had a huge hit called Down Yonder, and I played this for her, and she was so impressed, and I was doing anything I could do to impress her, and because I could play by ear. So I learned, I guess, that God had blessed me with perfect pitch.
And I was going to ask you that, how did the mastering of the piano come along? How did you wind up doing that?
You just feel the keys. You're taught by your teacher just to feel the keys. You certainly don't have to look at the piano to play. You find middle C, and to this day, when I sit down at the piano, I can immediately go find middle C. And I don't have to tap it to find it. I just know where it is, because when I was 8, she taught me that. And as I grew up in school, I had other piano teachers that would bring me to a new level. Now, the only thing they allowed us to play at school was classical music. So it was Mozart, Bach, and Beethoven, and Liszt, and Brahms, and all that. And the only thing I was used to was Flatt and Scruggs, and Bill Monroe, and the Stanley Brothers, and all that. So it was a culture clash for me. So as soon as I learned to play the violin, I started playing all those hoedowns from records that I'd heard by Tommy Jackson, a great fiddle player. I started playing those hoedowns on the fiddle in the practice hall, and a teacher came by, Mr. Wallace Greaves, and he said, "Wait a minute, you're not supposed to play that." please practice the things that we have studied in our classes together. And I said, yes, sir. So I did that. But I always went over the edge. And any time I had the chance, I played the Tommy Jackson fiddle hoedown tunes. And on the piano, any time I had the chance, I would play the things that I wanted to hear. Eventually, you know, later on in life, it was February the 3rd, 1959, the day the music died, when Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, and the Big Bopper were killed in a plane crash in Iowa. And we were holding a little wake. A friend of mine named Jay Spell and I were holding this because it was a troubling time. And they had pianos all over the campus, Ted. They had pianos in the dormitories. They had pianos all over the academic area where we went to school. And they had practice halls, which means there were like probably 12 rooms on one hall, small rooms with a piano. And they had another hall that was for the girls, for their practice rooms, another 12 set of rooms over there. So, and never any of that could come together. The boys and girls were totally segregated. But, you know, we weren't interested in anything at that time of our lives. So, but the February the 3rd, 1959, when the day the music died, we were in there playing Buddy Holly and playing Ritchie Valens, and I was singing, "Oh, Don." I was singing, and we did "La La 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 Bamba" with a bamba thing. We were doing Buddy Holly songs. Every day it's a getting closer, going faster than a roller coaster, and all that stuff. Playing the pianos, both there's two pianos in that room. And the head of the music department came in and said, "Wait a minute, stop all this. Let me tell you something. You two guys are out of the music department. You are kicked out right now. You are expelled from the music department. So you can't come back in this practice hall." But it was kind of crazy because we didn't get to go play the competition at the music festivals. And so eventually they discovered they wanted us back the next year. So we worked our way back into the music department. But we got kicked out. I got kicked out several times because I was doing the Jerry Lee Lewis stuff and the Fats Domino stuff. And you weren't supposed to practice that in the practice halls. You're supposed to practice what you're learning, your assignments that you'd been taught when you had your private piano lessons. But I couldn't just stick with that. You know, I heard Blue Monday by Fats Domino. I said, "Hey, man, I got to play that. I got to play that." And, you know, so the School for the Blind, like I said, in 1963, after I'd graduated, it was renamed the Governor Moorhead School for the Blind. And I was taught by my counselor when I was in high school that, and I made excellent grades. I loved school. I absolutely did. I loved it. Just soaked it up like a sponge, man. And eventually I got out from the influence of all those, you know, bad house parents, and really starting to enjoy life. And I will mention, it's in the book, Almost Like a Song, by Ronnie Millsap, in March of 1957. So I was 14, and I was in the study hall in the with a friend of mine, named Mac Grindstaff, was there in the school. We were down there. We were typing our assignments. We had learned to type since the third grade, so we could write home to our folks and all that. And we were sitting down there this evening in March of 1957, early March. And a house father came out and said, because we were making probably too much noise and, you know, laughing and carrying on. It was you know, as young teenagers will do. And he hit Mac and knocked his glasses off. And they broke on the floor. not tile, but concrete floor wherever we were there in the study area where the typewriters were. And I turned around to him and I said, "Why did you do that?" And he hauled off and slapped me on the left side of the face with all the power he had, knocked me out of the chair, fell on the floor. And so I went to bed. The next morning when I woke up, all I could see was a sea of red where I'd had some vision in the left eye. All there is a sea of red. So I went to his room and I said, "What have you done? I can't see out of my eye anymore. All I can see is red." And he said, "Well, we can't cry over spilled milk, can we?" That was his reaction. So I went to the infirmary on campus, and they looked and they said, "I don't know what has happened. There's nothing we can really do for you. You need to go back to class." So I went back to class and couldn't see anything then, couldn't see the sidewalks. I could before. So, and a 90-acre campus, navigating your way around a 90-acre campus is, you know, if you can see the sidewalks, that helps. So I went back to class and came back to the dormitory and doing my homework. And I remember walking into the bathroom that night and turning the light switch on and off, on and off, on and off, and could not tell the difference. So then I knew I was actually totally blind. No vision whatsoever. So, you know, I was in a blind school, so I was good. I was in a blind school. Oh, God. So, you know, but my counselors advised me to, I'd made great grades through high school. They advised me to go on to college. And what do you want to do in college? And I said, "Well, I want to be a musician." And they said, "No, we won't let you do that. The state of North Carolina, you're on scholarship. They'll send you anywhere to go to college. Maybe perhaps the University of North Carolina. That would be a real good place for you to go. They don't have a music department over there, so you can't study music. And the thought of being a musician, you got to get that out of your head." I said, "But I've studied 12 years of classical training here at the school. I have perfect pitch. I can play by ear. I can hear something once or twice and mimic it." I said, "No, you can't do that. You can't do that. You've got to find something, an academic interest." I said, "Well, I love history. I love political science. How about if I go and try to study to be a lawyer?" And he said, "Yeah, that's a good idea. At the University of North Carolina?" And I said, "No, I want out of North Carolina." "What?" "I want out of North Carolina. I'm tired of being in North Carolina. I want out. My grandfather lives over in Clay County now, over near the Georgia line. He lives in Hayesville, North Carolina. There's a junior college over there named Young Harris College in Young Harris, Georgia. That's where I want to go, to junior college. It's a two-year process. Then I go to Emory University in Atlanta for a year. Then I go to Emory Law School." And they said, "Okay, you know what? That's a real good plan. Let us investigate that." And they came back and said, "That's fine. You want to go to Young Harris for 2 years? You go ahead and do that." So in the fall of 62, I checked into Young Harris. I'm the only blind student on campus, and that was fine because in a week or so, they discovered that I could fill up a room by playing the piano and singing. I could sing everybody's songs. I could sing the Miracles. I could sing Jackie Wilson. I could sing Roy Orbison. I could sing every Elvis song you could name. And so I found a way to break the ice. It's through the music. That's how you do it. So then all of a sudden, everybody wanted to know who this guy was. And then I was, you know, I got into a band. A guy introduced me up at Young Harris, said, would you come down to Gainesville, Georgia? I play drums with this band. Would you come down to Gainesville, Georgia, and play in our band for the weekend? I said, yeah, I'd love to. So I went down there to Gainesville, Georgia, and sat in with them that night at the Gainesville Civic Center. Early fall of 1962, and there was a guy in the band that played guitar named Joe Lothridge. Joe was from a very wealthy family. There was Lothridge Brothers Construction. They built roads all over the state of Georgia. And so Joe was my age, and he ran the band. And once he heard me sing that night, he said, God, Ron, everybody called me Ron back then. Ron, you got to come join the band, man. I said, what, join what band? Join this band. I said, okay, all right. Well, what do you want me to do? He said, well, you just got to join the band. I said, all right. I'm going to college at Young Harris Junior College. So, you know, he said, I'm going to come pick you up on Friday, next Friday at 3 o'clock when you get through your classes. I said, okay, that's fine. And I've got Friday night and Saturday night booked for the band. So now you're the singer and the piano player. I said, okay, all right. So next Friday at 3 o'clock, here comes Joe Lothridge up there in his, I'm told, candy apple red Corvair that's all souped up and supercharged. And it usually takes an hour and a half to go from Young Harris to Gainesville, but he did it in 45 minutes. He cut it in half because we would go, whoa, squalling around all those curves. And it was scary. He was going fast and running around those curves. And I think in 62, we didn't even have seatbelts in him. At that time, no seatbelts. So I thought, well, I'm dead. Around we get down to his folks' house, and he said, okay, we're at the house. And my mother's name is Inez Lothridge. I said, well, what do I call her? He said, well, call her anything you want to. Can I call her Mom? Is that okay? Yeah, call her anything you want. I said, okay. So we walk in the house, and she says, hey, Ron, I got something for you. Stick out your left hand. And I said, yes, ma'am. I stuck out my left hand, a big tall glass. And I stick out your right hand. I stuck out my right hand, a big tall glass. I guess they were called vodka Collins, those drinks back then. So I had one in each hand, and I worked my way in there. Joe, who was my age, was so nice. He had picked me up at Young Harris, drove me down. So we started playing in the band, you know, with Joe Lothridge. But that's kind of the story, Ted, how it worked. And, you know, I eventually met the lady in 1964 in April. I met the lady that I dated for a year and a half. And then we were married October 30th, 1965. So that's we've been married 41 years, and it's is that right? 42 years.
She'd slap me now if she heard that.
But it's marriage is an interesting thing. It's all about trust.
When you were 5 years old, of course, I guess maybe it would be a little bit even too premature to say that, but did you ever dream? A little earlier, we were playing some music, and Don't Cry Daddy by Elvis came on, and Ronnie said, I played piano on that song.
That's right.
Did you ever, if you went back in those days, even when you were listening to the rock and roll music, and someone would have said, now, Ronnie, you're going to play the piano on a session for probably the biggest rock and roll performer that ever lived, what would you have thought? Would you have believed any of that?
No, I absolutely would not. He was the voice of my generation. I never in my wildest dreams ever thought that I would meet him. Of course, I'm listening to the radio all the time, so I knew all those songs. I thought, you know, when he went from Sun Records to RCA, I knew when that first thing happened. I Want You, I Need You, I Love You, the first single on RCA. I thought, whoa, he's got the Jordanaires behind him there in 56. Then he came with Heartbreak Hotel and Don't Be Cruel, the backside Hound Dog. I thought, God. What a year for this 21-year-old man. And I'm thinking, you know what? He's just 8 years older than I am. God. Then they came out with, in the fall of 56, with Love Me Tender. I was so disappointed with that record. Of course, it was all for the movie. He made an appearance in that movie. But I was so disappointed.
But then there you come, later down the road.
Yeah, but I will say I did love the B-side. When I turned the record over, the B-side was Any Way You Want Me. And I thought, oh, there's the Elvis I know. He's still there. So on down the road, I had no idea. My wife and I lived in Atlanta. A producer... my record company was Scepter Records out of New York, run by a Jewish lady named Florence Greenberg. And we had tried all kinds of things. The first record I had out on Scepter was a top five soul chart record called Never Had It So Good, written by Ashford and Simpson. And we'd tried some other things after that. We couldn't come back with a follow-up that would stick, and she called and sent me to Memphis to record with this producer in Memphis at American Studios named Chips Moman. And so I went down there and recorded some things with Chips, and Chips said, Ronnie, you need to move to Memphis. I said, well, I'm in Atlanta, and I got this Playboy gig down there, man, and it's working out really great for me, and I can't move to Memphis, but I'll come up here and record if you'll let me, and if it's approved through Scepter Records out of New York. So I started going up. I remember going in like July of 68, back up there and recording some more things and trying to get something to connect that would be radio, you know, it's getting on the radio even back then. And all of a sudden, Chips Moman says, I want you to move to Memphis. And I said, well, I can't. How can I move to Memphis? I've got this job in Atlanta that is working for me. And he came and heard me at the Playboy Club. He said, I swear you got to move to Memphis. I said, well, I don't know how. So he called me one day and said, I've got it figured out. You can work for a full-time gig at this nightclub called TJ's, owned by Herbie O'Mell. He's a friend of mine, and he's agreed to let you play there six nights a week. I said, for what? And he said, for $1,200. And I said, I got three guys in the band and me. And I said, well, you know, I can budget that and make that work. I can make that work. And he said, at the same time, you will be available to play over in the studio with me at American Studios. So whenever the sessions are going on, I'll know that from 9 to 1, when you're playing over there at TJ's, I'll know not to call a session. And on the sessions, you'll be able to make your living, take care of your family, and then at the same time be able to play on the recording sessions. I said, oh, that sounds cool, man. We'll move out of Atlanta. So we moved from Atlanta to Memphis on the Thanksgiving Day of 1968. We got to Memphis, and we found Joyce immediately found a place for us to live. And we got all set up in Memphis, and we started playing the TJ's thing with my band, and I had a great band, and started playing on recording sessions. And all of a sudden, Chip's Moment said, I want you to play on Felton Jarvis and I are producing a new album for Elvis Presley. I said, really? He always records in Nashville. He said, yeah, he does, but he wants to do an album in Memphis. I said, okay, well, just call me when you need me, man. And so he did, and I got to meet Elvis. And by then, my name was M-I-L-S-A-P, because that had been actually printed in the Atlanta Constitution. And now, what am I trying to say, Donnie? That's the newspaper, isn't it? The Atlanta Constitution, yeah. They had actually printed it years before that somebody had seen me and they didn't know my name, and so they spelled it M-I-L-S-A-P. And it's distributed all over Georgia, so I thought, well, you know, if it's distributed in the newspaper that way, that's got to be my last name. So I legally went and had my name changed to that.
But here you are going on to an Elvis session.
Yeah, I'm going on to an Elvis session.
You're telling me later on, here you are in the studio.
Yeah.
And you're singing now with the Jordanaires behind you.
Yeah, I sure am. The first time I met Elvis, I said, Elvis, this is Ronnie Millsap. He said, yeah. I said, pleasure to meet you, Mr. Elvis Presley. I'm a huge fan. You're the voice of my generation. And so I played on some sessions and sang on some sessions. And all of a sudden it comes New Year's Eve when 69 turns 7, 1970. And Elvis wants to book just exclusive the club TJ's to have his New Year's Eve party. So I did that 1969 turned 1970 and 1970 turned 1971. Sit around at the table and actually just talk with Elvis about anything you want to talk about, man. And that was as cool as it ever get. And my memories of him were very, very positive. I think he was an incredible man that had a lot on him. He was an entertainer that internationally, of course, everybody will always know the name Elvis Presley. It offends me when people say Elvis Presley, because honestly, it's Presley. That's the way it was, and that's the way he wanted his name to be pronounced. And everybody goes, Elvis Presley. I turn them off on the radio when they do that, Ted.
you've had an amazing, amazing career.
Yeah.
And it doesn't look to me like it's going to slow down anytime soon. You're out on the road. You're singing.
Yep.
You've got new product coming out. New recordings. You've been telling me a little bit about this. We want to look forward to seeing you in the future and hearing you in the future.
Absolutely.
And want to listen for you on the ham radio airwaves.
Absolutely. I'll be on the ham radio every chance I get.
And I really appreciate you talking to me. We'll continue this though. We'll have to have a part two to this. Sometime very, very soon.
I'm ready for that, baby.
All right. Very good.
Thank you. Mr. Ted Randall, I always appreciate your friendship, sir, and it's a true honor to be with you.
And I thank you so very much.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to QSO. It's all about amateur radio. Our guest this week has been Ronnie Millsap of part one of a three-part series. We invite you to tune in again next week, same time, same station, WBCQ at 7415 kilohertz for another program of QSO, once again heard on WBCQ at 3 p.m. and 11 p.m. Eastern. This is Ted Randall saying thank you for joining us. If you've enjoyed QSO, we invite you to pass the word along to your friends and tell them about this radio broadcast. And go to the website at www.tedrandall.com. That's spelled TEDRANDALL. All the interviews heard on WBCQ are available by podcast on that website. Thank you for joining us on QSO.